for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Bill of Rights was set up to limit the power of the U.S. federal government and protect the liberties of the people. It consists of the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. As part of our continuing series, The Constitution Today, we look at the history of the Bill of Rights and what it means to current-day American society and law. Joining us here in the studio, Nina Totenberg of NPR, A.E. Dick Howard of the University of Virginia, and Susan Block of Georgetown University. Joining us from the NPR New York Bureau, Jeffrey Toobin of The New Yorker and CNN. Of course, we invite your contributions this morning. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good to have you here. Dick Howard, very briefly, tell us what's in those first 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights.
Diane, I can assure you that they are brief and to the point.
Okay.
They're mercifully short. As legal documents go, this is one that anybody can get his or her hands around.
Good.
And there are 10 of them, as you say, and the first one is the one that obviously attracts most people's attention because that protects or guarantees very basic rights such as speech, press, religion, and the like. But then there's some other amendments that also deal in particular with criminal justice, with procedural guarantees. And they, stated broadly, are essentially what James Madison and the founders of these documents thought to be the core values of a free people.
Right to keep and bear arms, protection from quartering of troops, protection from unreasonable search and seizure, due process, trial by jury, civil trial by jury, prohibition of excessive bail, cruel and unusual punishment, protection of rights not specifically enumerated in the Constitution, powers of states, and powers of the people. Jeffrey Toobin, which parts of the Bill of Rights are the most relevant today?
I'm just following along because I brought my copy because I didn't want a Christine O'Donnell type of embarrassment at any point.
I understand.
What's the most important? I suppose the First Amendment is the most important because that allows us to complain loud enough so that if people are distorting the rest of the Constitution, the people in power can be changed. But, I think what is so interesting about reading the Constitution is that, first of all, it doesn't take very long, as Dick pointed out, and also it's a system. I mean, the parts work together. And, you know, what is so striking about reading the Bill of Rights again is that it is really a series of limits. It is what I suppose modern folks would call a libertarian-style document in the sense it's a list of things that the federal government cannot do in order so that citizens may be left alone. And what always strikes me in reading it together is that it is really very clearly a political document aimed at limiting the power of the federal government.
And Nina Totenberg, what do you believe Americans should know most importantly about that Bill of Rights?
Well, I actually think that one of the things that American citizens should keep in mind is that after the founders wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, they immediately disagreed among themselves about what it meant. So it is no surprise that today people disagree about what it means. And when you hear people say, it should only mean what the founders intended at the time, they didn't agree on what they intended at the time. So it's a really constitutional interpretation is a really broad area, and it has lots of room for disagreements.
And Susan Block, why was it created in the first place?
Well, it's interesting. The framers of the Constitution didn't believe they needed a Bill of Rights, and in fact didn't have one. In their view, it was unnecessary because the federal government was a government of limited powers, and there was no need to have this explicit limitation. It was only as the states were ratifying it that they demanded, as a condition of their ratification, that the Madison and the others agree to provide a Bill of Rights when the first Congress would meet. And so, in fact, what happened is the original Constitution had no Bill of Rights. One of the first things that the members of the brand new Congress did was proposed actually 12 amendments.
And two of those
did not get ratified by the complex process we have for amending the Constitution. But the first 10, or the 10 that we have, were ratified. The 11th actually got ratified, but only in 1990, many, many years later. And the 12th has never been ratified.
You don't mean 1990?
I do.
You do. The 11th Amendment?
No. I don't mean the 11th Amendment. I'm sorry. Of the 12 that were initially proposed, 10 were immediately ratified. Of the initial 12, the 11th. It's now the 27th, but got ratified.
Thank you for that clarification. Sorry. What were the precedents for the Bill of Rights? Dick Howard.
Well, Diane, it's interesting that in the era in which the framers worked, they already knew about Bills of Rights. The English had a Bill of Rights in 1689 at the time of the so-called Glorious Revolution. That was, in effect, a parliamentary struggle against the Stuart kings. And so they came up with a Bill of Rights, which, by the way, you will find has provisions, some of which occur in our Bill of Rights. For example, the right to bear arms, the not questioning legislator speech in other places, cruel and unusual punishment, those all come from English law. The more immediate precedents for the framers at Philadelphia were the state bills of rights, in particular George Mason's Declaration of Rights for Virginia, 1776. And I think those documents were important because they show a transition from an English understanding of bills of rights, a sort of notion of ancient practice in English constitutionalism, to something that was more grounded in natural law, natural rights. It's interesting that in Virginia, they actually drafted the Declaration of Rights first and then went on to the business of drafting a constitution for the Commonwealth of Virginia, the understanding being, rather like John Locke in the Social Compact, that rights precede government, that people, we don't depend on government for our rights. It's not given to us by government. We have them because we're human. And then, so the Bill of Rights are, in effect, a way of restating those rights and saying government has to respect them.
A.E. Dick Howard, he's at the University of Virginia. He's professor of law and public affairs. Susan Block, professor of law at Georgetown University. Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent, and by line with us from New York, Jeffrey Toobin. He's staff writer at The New Yorker, senior legal analyst for CNN. Do join us. I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Jeffrey Toobin, back to you. What do you perceive as the most misunderstood portion of the Bill of Rights?
Well, I don't know if it's misunderstood exactly, but I think the changing nature of what the Bill of Rights means is probably best illustrated in contemporary terms by the Second Amendment, because we spent decades, those of us who went to law school in the 80s or before, thinking that the Second Amendment did not guarantee individuals the right to keep and bear arms. But you know, we had several presidents elected who believed differently, who thought that there was a personal right granted by the Second Amendment. They appointed justices who shared that view, and now it is quite clear that the Second Amendment, as interpreted by the current court, does give individuals a right to keep and bear arms, and it is not at all clear what, if any, gun control laws are still constitutional. So, you know, the fact that the Bill of Rights says a lot of things doesn't mean that its meaning doesn't change, sometimes dramatically, over the years.
Nina.
And another example of that is campaign finance law. You know, for 100 years it was understood and as a sort of given that it was constitutional to ban ban corporations and unions from spending on candidate elections. And this year, the court, by a 5-4 vote, said that isn't true. So, we had the court reverse itself on school integration, on segregation. You may have different views on campaign finance, on the Second Amendment right to bear arms. I suspect there are very few people who have a different view about Brown versus the Board anymore. But when it happened in 1954, it was extremely controversial. Virginia shut down its schools rather than comply.
So you've got an evolutionary process even in the Bill of Rights, Susan Block.
It's true. And as Nina pointed out earlier, the people who wrote the Bill of Rights and the Constitution generally didn't agree on everything as to what the interpretation was. So it is a living document, and as technology changes, as circumstances change, the interpretation changes.
Susan Block, she's professor of law at Georgetown University. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we've got lots of callers. I look forward to speaking with you.
Diane Rehm Sunday is just ahead here on WAMU 88.5 and 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. Hope you're enjoying your afternoon. I'm Elliot Francis.
Support for WAMU's recent membership campaign comes from your contributions and from our in-kind food donors, InStyle Caterers, and Faccia Luna. For more information, visit WAMU.org/in-kind.
Mostly clear conditions tonight, lows in the upper 30s. Monday's outlook, sunny, with highs in the lower 50s. It's 65 degrees in Northeast Washington at 220.
This program of the Diane Rehm Show was recorded earlier, so we're not able to take new phone calls. But we welcome your comments at drshow.org or join us on Facebook.
And welcome back. We're continuing our series on the Constitution today. And we have with us, as we concentrate today on the Bill of Rights, Jeffrey Toobin. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, senior legal analyst for CNN, Susan Block, professor of law at Georgetown University, Dick Howard. He is at the University of Virginia and board member at James Madison's Montpelier, and Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent. Nina, before we open the phones, let's talk about the First Amendment, what it says, and how it has evolved.
It says Congress shall make no law respecting freedom of speech, religion, press. Now, there are absolutists who say no law means no law, but in our law, that has not prevailed. There are circumstances you can't shout. You can fire in a crowded theater. You can regulate the time, place, and manner of speech. There's also a conflict between, in the religion area, between freedom of religion, freedom to exercise your religion, and Congress making no law, because sometimes if you make no law, you can make some law to try to, for example, make it easier for people to worship when you do that, though, you may be favoring religion as opposed to not religion. And so there are those kinds of conflicts. Congress, for example, passed a law, I don't know, in the 1990s sometime, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act got struck down, basically, because it had too much favoring of religion. And so there's lots of room in the First Amendment. I want to say one thing about the free speech area, though. It's really interesting. And this is true in other areas of the Bill of Rights. Some pretty odious people have exercised their rights, and the court has said you have the right to do it. And it's one of the reasons we have life tenure for federal judges and for the court, and the Constitution allows you not to take away their salaries, to reduce their salaries, to give them some protection so they can do those unpopular things that reflect a larger sense of values for all of us, so that when somebody very odious has the right to speak, so do I, who may be slightly less odious.
Dick Howard, do you want to comment?
Yes, I think my nomination for the most misunderstood provision of the Bill of Rights would be the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. There's only one press clause, one speech clause, one assembly clause, one redress of grievance clause, but there are two religion clauses. Now, that's not redundancy. I think the framers understood what they were doing, certainly James Madison did, in putting free exercise of religion side by side with the anti-establishment principle. Free exercise is not too hard to understand. It may be hard to interpret in practice, but establishment means, if you like, separation between the wall of separation between church and state. Now, that's not the language in the First Amendment, but we understand that's what it means. And I think if you want to understand what religious freedom is about in America, it's not enough to talk about free exercise. It's important to recognize that the other pillar of religious freedom
he says
is
it's better than
the
I
establishment
did.
Clause.
All right. I'm going to open the phones and take a question on that issue. First to Bob, who's in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, sir.
Hi. I've never understood this hard line between religion and the Constitution. And I was really surprised at the laughter that accompanied Christine O'Donnell's answer about separation of church and state. I know when I was in the military, we had churches on the bases. We had chaplains. During boot camp, we were pretty much forced to go to Mass every Sunday. The Senate has the Congress, they have a chaplain, and they start each session with a prayer. And I understand that Thomas Jefferson, when he was president, he used to hold religious services in the White House. So the people who, it seems like back from the founding of the Constitution, there was no hard line between church and state. And in many aspects of our government today, There's no hard line.
Dick Howard.
Well, there's no hard line. I think the wall of separation is a metaphor. It's not meant to decide actual cases. Take the case of the instance of chaplains in the military. It's been long understood that if you take people and put them in uniform and send them off to military bases, you must not separate them from their spiritual advisors, and therefore, in order to fulfill the promise of free exercise of religion, one pays military chaplains. At the margin, certainly there are tensions between free exercise and establishment, and I think those have to be reconciled by way of occasional accommodation of religion, but this doesn't undermine the fundamental principle that government ought not to be in the business of, let's say, channeling money to religious organizations. It ought not to prefer one religion over another. The fundamental principle still yields to exceptions.
There's one other thing we have to remember. When you look at the broad sweep of American history, initially the Bill of Rights did not apply to the states. They only applied to the federal government.
Right.
And only really in the 20th century did the court begin applying them one by one to the states so that the same rules applied to the states that applied to the federal government. So the states, you know, way back when could have had laws that did limit speech, did limit some, you know, did impose some religious practices like prayer in schools. But the court, one by one, has said we're a system of one country, one set of laws, and the Bill of Rights does apply to the states.
Now, Bill from Galax, Virginia, asks, has the Supreme Court ever made a ruling on the amendments only to reverse itself in 4 years? He's thinking about campaign finance and how corporations can now donate anonymously. Jeffrey Toobin.
Well, the court reverses itself with some regularity. Perhaps the most famous and most dramatic reversal that the court ever did, it took place during World War II, when there was a case about whether Jehovah's Witnesses could say could be forced to say the Pledge of Allegiance or salute the flag without being expelled from school. The Jehovah's Witnesses wanted to be excused from that because they had a religious objection, and there was a case right before the war where Justice Felix Frankfurter said, this is part of going to school, you have to do it, or you get thrown out. And during World War II, in what is perhaps my favorite opinion in the whole history of the court, Barnett versus West Virginia, Justice Robert Jackson said, you know, we do not impose ideological conformity in this country. If your religious beliefs require you not to say the pledge, we've learned what happens when authoritarian governments take over. We're not going to insist on that. That was a very quick reversal. As for Citizens United, I wouldn't hold my breath for a quick reversal of that one.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up with you, Jeffrey Toobin, you mentioned the Second Amendment. Can we talk about what the intent of the framers was regarding the Second Amendment? Susan Block.
Well, can we talk about it? Yes. Will we agree? No. As was said previously, for up until very recently, we thought the Second Amendment just gave the right to bear arms so as to protect the states from federal government, so that states could have their own militia. But it was not an individual right to bear arms. But what we learned a few years ago from the Supreme Court is that that interpretation was wrong. And in fact, it is now held to be an individual right. And most recently, the court said that it's not just a right vis-a-vis the federal government, but the Second Amendment now, too, is incorporated so that it applies to the states. As Nina was speaking earlier about the notion of these rights being incorporated, we now have a new case that says Second Amendment is individual right vis-a-vis the states as well as the federal government.
Dick Howard.
Diane, I think the most remarkable transition in interpretation of the Bill of Rights took place during the Warren Court's era in the 1960s. As Nina pointed out, the Bill of Rights originally applied to the federal government only. The Supreme Court made that clear. It was only after the adoption of the 14th Amendment that it began to be possible that the Bill of Rights might apply to the states. And
we should say what the 14th Amendment is. 14th Amendment.
14th Amendment is the one that state says that no state shall deny due process of law or equal protection of the law or privileges and immunities of citizenship. Now, that clearly applied to the states, but it didn't specifically reference the Bill of Rights. Justice Black, during the 1940s, had an argument. He said, in my judgment, the 14th Amendment's due process and privileges and immunities clauses apply to the states, all of the provisions of the Bill of Rights. Now, he was never able to get four other votes on the court to sell that proposition wholesale, but starting in about 1961, in one case after another, the Supreme Court began holding that this amendment and that amendment and that amendment do apply to the states. For example, the right to have counsel appointed if you're not able to afford one used to be decided by the court on a purely ad hoc basis, but after 1963, Gideon versus Wainwright, the court said, it's a universal rule. So basically, we passed a real threshold in the 1960s so that nearly every one of the procedural guarantees of the Bill of Rights now apply to the states by way of the 14th Amendment.
So what happened to the Second Amendment as we evolved, Nina?
Well, Interestingly, there were very few cases that went to the Supreme Court. I think there was one in the 30s about machine guns, where the court said, yeah, you can ban machine guns for individuals. But there were almost no cases, and it really was a given. It's very hard to convince people that even in my reporting lifetime in the 1980s, I remember doing a piece about this. Chief Justice Berger gave an interview to Parade magazine and said it's just silly to suggest that the Second Amendment is an individual right. I think Robert Bork said that. But over time, it became a big sort of political issue and a kind of an intestinal part almost of conservative jurisprudence off of the bench, I would say. And eventually that migrates to the bench. And so that the people that conservative Republican presidents are appointing came to accept that idea. And when they look at history, they saw something different than what people had accepted for centuries, not decades, centuries.
Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Jeffrey Toobin, do you want to weigh in?
I just like to point out, you know, what Susan said, that, you know, of course the Constitution is a living document that changes in meaning over time. You know, that is a very well-established view. It is also intensely controversial.
Exactly.
The Republicans on the Judiciary Committee spent a great deal of time haranguing Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, accusing them of believing in a living constitution, because that is now an article of faith, that's a bad thing if you are
and vice versa.
A conservative. And vice versa. Although it's interesting that the Democrats don't embrace the living constitution all that much. They're sort of in a half-hearted way, say, well, you know, Brown v. Board of Education was right.
I remember when John Roberts was being confirmed, he was asked more than once whether he thought the Constitution was a living document. And he was asked that by Democrats. And he gave, as I recall, an answer saying that, yes, he did think it was a living document under certain circumstances.
Nina, as usual, trust you implicitly. Don't remember that exchange particularly. But I have been struck by how, living constitution has become an epithet. I mean, an outright, assumed to be an incorrect way of looking at the Constitution in recent years. And I think that's just, an example of how controversial the Constitution is.
You know, I must say the one amendment that confuses me the most is the Ninth, which offers protection of rights not specifically enumerated in the Constitution. So what does that do? Does that sort of say everything we've said so far, now we're going to cover everything else that we haven't said, Susan?
Well, the Ninth Amendment is an enigma. Judge Bork called it an ink blot and said, basically, it doesn't mean anything. You can read anything into it, so therefore it means nothing. The court doesn't pay much attention to it, in part, I think, for the reason that led to your question of, does it make everything else in the document totally irrelevant because
everything
the Ninth Amendment
is covered,
right? So it's a constant debate, and the reality is it doesn't have teeth.
Has it come up in Supreme Court cases? I'm looking.
Yes. It was actually relied on prior to Roe v. Wade, when the cases leading up to that, they started as over challenging state bans on contraception. That was sort of the prelude to Roe v. Wade. And Justice Goldberg, relied on the Ninth Amendment to say that people had an inherent right to decide whether to have children or not. He relied on the Ninth, but the court did not. And I think it's one of the only situations where some people tried to read something into it, and then they backed off.
Yeah.
But
Diane,
oh, sorry,
I think
ahead,
I think that Susan is quite right. The Ninth Amendment has been rarely invoked in Supreme Court cases, and I think one reason is, aside from its being enigmatic, is that the court's got the Due Process Clause. And when you've got the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, that's the one the court has used in cases like Griswold dealing with contraception, Roe versus Wade dealing with abortion, on and on. They've created a whole panoply of privacy rights, autonomy rights, even as recently as Lawrence versus Texas, where they held that gay rights were protected by the Constitution. The Due Process Clause has been so malleable and so expansive that, in effect, it's done the job which might have been done otherwise by the Ninth Amendment.
Nina or Jeffrey?
Jeffrey has something he wants to say.
No, the moment passed.
Yeah, and made Jeffrey Toobin, he's staff writer at The New Yorker, senior legal analyst for CNN. We'll take a short break. When we come back, your calls, your comments. I look forward to hearing from you.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, Are We Ready to Laugh at Terrorism? A new film brings slapstick humor to a serious subject. Plus, sensitivity training isn't just for American workers anymore. What we can learn from attitudes abroad from Switzerland to Singapore. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
Hi, this is Ed Walker, offering heartfelt congratulations to Rob Bamberger, who's celebrating 30 years of hosting Hot Jazz Saturday Night on WAMU 88.5. We're inviting you to join friends and fans for dining and dancing on New Year's Eve at the Omni Shoreham Hotel in Washington. We'll also use the occasion to kick off WAMU 88.5's 50th anniversary celebration. For tickets and additional information, visit WAMU.org.
And we're back with our continuing series on the Constitution. Today, concentrating on the Bill of Rights. Here's a question on Facebook. Freedom of speech versus hate speech. Does Europe have it right? Should we ban hate speech? Jeffrey Toobin.
Well, I think this is one of the great examples where you can have a civilized country with different rules than ours. In Germany, which is a free and vibrant democracy, it is simply illegal, and you can go to jail for advocating Nazism. Given Germany's history, you can certainly understand why they have a rule like that. But in this country, there is really a very strong tradition of not limiting speech on the basis of its content, political or otherwise. And, I'm an American. That's the tradition I'm much more comfortable with. I don't think hate speech should be limited in any way that's usually talked about. But you can see why different countries have different rules. Canada has different rules about this sort of thing. But I think our rule is much more easy to administer and much more in keeping with our limited government tradition.
And anyway, what's hate speech? Try defining it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. To Winston Salem, North Carolina. Good morning, Timothy.
Good morning. My question concerns the part of the First Amendment that guarantees freedom of religion. Was there ever a case in which the Supreme Court ruled that freedom of religion also meant by implication freedom from religion? What was that case and when was it made? When was the ruling made?
Dick Howard.
Well, I think there have been a long line of cases that suggest not that the country is free from religion, but that the government may not force religion upon people or endorse religion over non-religion or one sect over another. That really began to percolate in the mid-20th century, starting with school prayer and Bible reading and that sort of thing. I think the court has been particularly concerned about, if you like, captive audiences, school children. I think it's less concerned about religious speech in more public places. But in effect, the court has tried to prevent government from using its coercive power to force people to accept one view of religion or another. So yes, there are a number of Supreme Court cases which do just that.
The Eighth Amendment says there is a prohibition of excessive bail and cruel and unusual punishment. Does that in any way, Susan, rule against capital punishment?
Well, the question is complicated in part because also in the Constitution, where we have the Due Process Clause, it says that the government shall not take away life without due process. And so those people who say, they say, well, that means that the government can take away life so long as it complies with the due process. So in that view, the Eighth Amendment does not prohibit the death penalty. On the other hand, some like Justice Marshall and Justice Brennan have said that the way the death penalty is administered is so haphazard and fraught with prejudice, really, that whether, you know, maybe if there were a perfect system, you could have the death penalty, but there has never been a perfect system. No one seems to know how to make a perfect system. And so their view is that the Eighth Amendment does prohibit.
But there's nobody sitting on the Supreme Court today who has said that he believes that capital punishment or she believes that capital punishment is per se unconstitutional.
And although even, Stevens.
No, he didn't. And he didn't. He Justice Stevens, who just retired, and did an interview with me in which he talked about this extensively, and he said, I voted to uphold the death penalty in the mid-1970s because we were putting such strict rules in on who could, on what prosecutors could do in selecting a jury, and other rules that protected the whole process. And the court more recently has taken away those rules and made it a more lopsided system. And in view of that, I could not support the death penalty. But he said if they had stuck with the way they had been doing it in the 70s,
yeah,
he said he thought that he would still be supporting the death penalty.
Dick Howard.
Diane, the cruel and unusual punishment provision is the paradigm example of what we might call the living Constitution. It is true that the Supreme Court has stopped short of outright abolition of the death penalty, but starting in the 1970s and continuing to the present time, they've had case after case deciding just what the meets and bounds of capital punishment are. And to give one fascinating example, in 1989, in two cases, the court upheld the death penalty for youthful offenders and for the somewhat mentally retarded. And then in cases in 2002 and 2005, the court itself overruled its own precedents to show how this concept continually evolves.
Let's go now to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Dimitri.
Good morning, Diane. In listening to your discussion, I want to release the catch on my 45 when I hear people talking about the Constitution, because it usually starts out like what it really means. So I think the Constitution has become useless at this state. My question to your panel is, Aristotle wrote a book, an essay called Politics, and he points out the fact that a monarchy is preferable to democracy, that democracy is doomed to failure. And my question is, what does the panel think about this?
Jeffrey Toobin.
I just can't get over that caller's voice. He sounds just like William Rehnquist, who is no longer with us. But Midwestern accent that William Rehnquist had, which is neither here nor there.
I don't think he had a 45 either.
Yeah, well, I don't know. But I urge you to keep that 45 holstered if at all possible, even though it's now clear you have a right to have it. I don't know. That question's above my pay grade. Take someone else. That's too hard.
What do you think?
Well, you know, what that question puts me in mind of is forms of government which have concerned us from the time of Aristotle to the present time. And I think that in talking about the Bill of Rights, I think we ought to remember that Madison in particular was concerned that bills of rights by themselves were not enough. So he and the framers put into play, and this is responsive to the question about the Constitution, that they understood that checks and balances, separation of powers, federalism, structural limitations, limiting power so that you play one faction off against another, these were thought to be among the primary ways of protecting individual rights. You don't just rely on the enumeration of rights in the Bill of Rights. You limit power so that government becomes limited government. And that's one of the, surely, the key functions of the Constitution.
Nina.
And, you know, there are some things that we do in modern governance that people think are in the Constitution that are not, that lead to a lot of gridlock. For example, the filibuster is just a custom of the Senate. It's a rule of the Senate. It is not in the Constitution. And I'm sure there are many other rules in the modern administrative state that are not in the Constitution.
On the other hand, as we talked last week in the first of our series, one criticism of the Constitution today is that it is so difficult to amend. Now, what's your thought on that, Susan?
Oh, thank God for that. That's all I can say.
That was Jeffrey.
You know, that was Jeffrey Toobin.
Well, when you look at the passing political fancies that we all get involved with, it is good that it's hard to amend the Constitution. This is our foundation document. That has stood us in very good stead for well more than 200 years. And other than very fundamental rules like, you know, should women get the right to vote? Should 18-year-olds get the right to vote, which are some of the more recent amendments, I think it is much better to keep contemporary political debates in Congress where they belong, and rather than tying the country's hands for generations, which is what you do when you amend the Constitution.
Do you want to add to that?
Well, I agree with what Jeffrey said. I just wanted to point out that after the first 10 amendments that we're talking about today primarily, in the next 200 years, we've only added 17 more. So it is very, very difficult,
yes.
and they made it deliberately difficult.
And two of them were about drinking.
Right.
And we have another message on Facebook from Thomas, who wants us to discuss the 10th Amendment and what motivated its inclusion in the Bill of Rights. Dick.
The 10th Amendment is the one that says the powers not delegated to the United States nor prohibited to the states are reserved to the states or to the people. Now, that's also a bit enigmatic, but it, among other things, was clearly meant to assuage the concerns of critics of the original Constitution, the so-called anti-federalists. They were concerned that the Constitution would create an overweening federal power, a tyrannical central government. This was meant to say, no, the states still exist. They have a constitutional integrity. They do have rights of their own. Now, that particular amendment seemed to have been read out of the Constitution by the Warren Court back in the 60s. It really came back by way of William Rehnquist and others in the 1990s. It's really part of the sort of balance wheel of American federalism.
Yeah,
but I think it's if I could just jump in here.
Sure.
Again, the contemporary political relevance of the 9th and 10th Amendments, both are regularly cited by the Tea Party movement. I mean, the Tea Party movement, whatever you think of it, thinks a lot about the Constitution, and the 9th and 10th Amendments as checks on federal power is something that people in the Tea Party often discuss. Now, whether they could give that any teeth or make a practical change to how the government operates is another question, but it is regularly cited as a check on federal power by those folks.
Susan.
No, I agree with that. I mean, at one point in the 1940s, the Supreme Court just said the 10th Amendment basically doesn't say anything. It's a truism. It just says the powers you didn't give to Congress, you didn't give to Congress, but it doesn't really say anything. Today, there's more teeth in the 10th Amendment. Congressional laws are being struck down for, quote, commandeering the states, for forcing the states to do things. So,
give me an example.
The Brady Bill.
The Brady Bill was one. A small part of the Brady Bill was struck down on that. A federal law dealing with waste was part of it was struck down because it was forcing the states to take title to the waste. So there's teeth in the 10th Amendment now that...
And yet we do have to say, you do have to, when you're looking at this, you do have to say two things. We fought a civil war over states' rights. And the idea of the federal government as bigger, stronger, better, whatever, maybe not better, but bigger and stronger, and preemptive won. And so that battle, to some extent, people read parts of the Constitution and they forget about the Civil War amendments that give the federal government power to regulate the states. That's number one. And number two, going back to the Ninth Amendment, it often is a question of whose ox is being gored. There was a period of time not that long ago when liberals loved the Ninth Amendment because they wanted to read all kinds of rights into it, personal rights into it. And they saw it as a sort of expansive thing. Now it's conservatives or Tea Party movementers. It depends.
Nina Totenberg of NPR. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Hank, who says, is the Second Amendment a two-part or a one-part amendment? If two parts, a right to bear arms and a right for militias, or one part, arms with and for militias. Dick Howard.
Well, it's very interesting. The Second Amendment has its roots in the English Bill of Rights and then in American state constitutions. And it's a wonderful example of what original intent yields whatever you think it means. It gives rise to law office history. You read the relevant parts of the historical interpretation. And it seems to me the language is pretty clear that you have a clause at the beginning referring to the militia, which qualifies and modifies the right of the people to keep and bear arms. But the respective camps on the U.S. Supreme Court in the D.C. versus Heller case, one camp said, oh, it means individual rights. The other camp said it means collective rights. They read the same history. They came up with totally different answers. So I guess the answer at the moment is the majority, the five-person majority on the court, has collapsed these two phrases into one.
Is that how you see it?
That is what the 5-4 majority did. The amendment reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Most people thought that that meant that in order to keep a well-regulated militia, people could have arms. But the way the Supreme Court has read it is they basically ignored the part about a well-regulated militia.
Nina?
Well, I think that the court, you know, when I went to the argument in that case, Justice Kennedy, who was pivotal in this, basically said, who doesn't believe that you have the right to have a gun in your house to go to defend yourself or to go hunting? That's a sort of an intrinsic guttural understanding. That seemed to be what he was thinking. And we have yet to understand how far the court believes that states and the federal government can go in regulating that. Can they limit carrying, you know, can they concealed weapon? Can they limit the kind of weapon you have? Can you have a street sweeper at home? You know, those questions have yet to be answered.
And it seems to me that as you think of the creation of the Constitution as creating a document that helps us to get along as a nation, here we are 250-odd years later, and we're still arguing.
Isn't that good?
I guess it's good, but it does raise as many questions as it answers, which is why I think this series is so important for me, and I hope for all of you. Nina Totenberg, Dick Howard, Susan Block, Jeffrey Toobin, thank you for your time, your expertise, and your presence. And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Each week we ask one simple question, just one, about somewhere in the world. Today we're in Mexico asking, what's a botanero? I'm with my friend Charlie, a California gringo turned Mexico resident at a place called Corporal in Manzanillo, a port town on Mexico's west coast. There's a blaring band on stage and a dozen families at tables around the open-air restaurant. Every table has a stand beside it. Charlie explains the basics.
This stand is a bucket of little beers, and they're 6-ounce beers, and they come in a bucket full of ice. And you just knock them back one after the other, and when they're done, you shove them upside down in the ice, and when they see a dozen beer bottles sticking bottom up, then they haul them off and bring back another one. And until you tell them to stop, they will keep bringing you beer and food.
The beers will cost you, but the food is free. So basically, the Botanero is a bar that serves botanas, or snacks. I peek at the kitchen as two women are making ceviche. When I get back, Charlie's found me a translator. His name is...
Jesus Pineda.
Jesus is 12. He lives in Texas, but he's visiting his grandparents here. He's been coming to this botanero since he was, well, younger than he is now.
What is a botanero?
Where they sing and, they give you different kind of food.
He stops and hones his description.
Singing songs and, drinking beer.
Are you drinking beer?
No.
Really, a botanero is like the Mexican version of a vaudeville variety show, only with tortilla soup and liquor. This one's also got a playground. Botaneros originated here in the state of Colima, and though you'll find a few scattered around the country, most of them are still right here, like this one, in operation for the last 40 years. I ask Jesus what the song's about.
The month of Christmas, he's so lonely and like all the years.
Jesus' explanation falters, and suddenly he says he has to go. It's unclear what's happening until a minute later when a black cowboy hat appears on his head, and there he is, with the band,